On this episode of Still Loading, a fantasy that's not quite so final. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of Still Loading of 2020. I am your host, Josh Koval, and to kick off this new year, we are actually kicking off the year with a listener request. And with me to ring in the new year and to ring in this first episode of first actually ever listener request episode is my friend Jamie. Jamie, how are you doing?
Hey, guys, I'm good.
So, Jamie, you were on once before, and it's a similar topic. You were on for the Final Fantasy VI/3 episode.
Mm-hmm.
And today we are talking about the original Final Fantasy for the NES/Famicom.
That's right.
So I guess the reason I asked you to be on this is, one, you're the only person I know who's beaten it.
Oh, because it's an amazing game and it's very, very difficult.
It's, well, would you agree it's more tedious than difficult, or does it get difficult towards the end?
It's repetitious and it's hard to learn because the game doesn't hold your hand, and also it's it's an original Nintendo game, so if you just pop the game in and started playing, there's a lot of things you don't understand about the game because you would need the manual to understand fully all the game aspects.
Yes.
Of it. Yep. So it's got a bit of a learning curve as far as not just learning the game, because it's a pretty straightforward RPG, but like
the mechanics are pretty simplistic overall.
Yeah, just understanding how things work.
So this was released in Japan on December 18th, 1987. For North America, I don't have a specific date, but I have July 1990.
Okay.
So it was like 3 years. I mean, that's how it was back on the NES. You would have games released years after they were in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, even Super Mario Bros. 3 was released, in 88 in Japan, and it wasn't released until like 1990 in the States. So anyway, the director of the game is Hironobu Sakaguchi. He has been the director of the series for quite a long time. Now he's one of the higher ups in Square Enix. I believe he still works for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And the composer is the legendary Nobuo Uematsu, the man that is up there with Koji Kondo as being synonymous with video game music. So let's dive right in. So the game begins with you choose four different heroes. There's four different classes. No, there's more than four classes. I'm sorry. There's a bunch of different classes.
Six different classes.
But you choose one. You choose four different characters. It could be four of the same class. It could be four of different classes, or whatever order you want. And each one of them carries darkened orbs or something like that. And essentially the premise of the game is the four heroes of light, you have to defeat the four fiends,
mm-hmm.
and then restore peace and balance to the universe, to the world, essentially.
There you go.
Essentially there's these crystals that once you defeat the fiend, the crystal lights up again, and that's pretty much how...
Yep, they all have the four orbs, and then as you defeat the elemental fiends, the orbs will come back to light. And then once all four orbs are brightened, you fulfill a prophecy in becoming the heroes of light, where your characters go from tiny little miniatures to big-ass adults.
There we go. So that, in a nutshell, is the story. We're going to go into a little bit more detail with that. But let's talk about the classes. Or let's go into the mm-hmm. battle mechanics, the game yeah. systems, and all that stuff. So you have the fighter.
Staple. Yep.
You have sword and board. The black belt.
You have a martial artist, yes, who is... If your fighter is your classic tank and spank, your black belt is the glass cannon of melee.
Especially early on.
Yeah, early on he does, he's got a real big curve. So early on he does okay damage, less than the fighter, less hits than the fighter. And then he goes through a whole curve of using nunchucks for a bit. You go through a town or two of gearing him up. But maybe a couple hours in the game, I think town 3... you stop being able to buy weapons for him. And again, this is something the manual tells you. You don't know. They don't indicate it. You have to unequip his nunchucks, and then he starts doing like Fists of Fury, and then he deals more attacks, higher damage, then he doesn't have weapons any further. His armor stays relative. It's like leather stuff. So he's like a glass cannon, second place fighter.
And then you have the White Mage.
Right.
The trilogy of mages, white, red, and black mages.
Right. Yep. Straight healing, straight damage for black, and then red is a little bit of both.
And then you have a thief.
Right.
I think that's the sixth, all six then, right?
That's thief the would be sixth, the last yep. one. So he's a lot more evasion and hit rating. He can hit more consistently. He has, obviously, he can dodge more. He doesn't deal as much damage as the fighter or the black belt, though. So for raw damage, he's more of a survivability character. I never completed the game with him. Wasn't my favorite. My personal team composition was first place fighter. Second place in your lineup is your black belt. Your third place I actually had as my red mage. My fourth place is white mage, because the red mage not only good at white and black magic, but he can actually use swords. So in like the first half of the game or first quarter of the game, he's comparable to your fighter. He can equip swords. He's right there with the damage. And then as the game progresses, he actually scales back on dealing physical damage significantly. And then of course he can't gain as much magic as the black mage, so that scales back. But he still deals the AoE magic that you need, and he can use all your items. So he's still
he can do utility. AoE magic? Because none of the other characters I've seen have been able to do AoE.
They do. Once you hit level 2 magic. So as a black mage, you get like fire and ice and it's single target, but then you get fire 2, ice 2, and it does groups of damage.
Oh, that's nice.
So it's
that's
utility. But
that's obnoxious yeah. in the first half. No, you were telling me before about how the learning curves, it's almost like the red mage and the black belt are going on opposite learning curves.
Yes.
Where the red mage is super OP in the beginning of the game, but mm-hmm. as the game goes on, he kind of just starts dipping.
Sure.
And then the black belt is kind of useless in the beginning half, but as the game goes on, he becomes so overpowered, it's insane.
Oh,
so
sure.
It's like, which do you want? Do you want everything up front and then hope that your whatever you have left over can like survive it all? But I guess that's also what's unique about the game is that if you really wanted to, you could go into it with four red mages.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can do whatever you want to mess around with. People have done achievements of running it with four white mages. And doing straight up just, they use maces and staves and just meleeing it down and just healing
it. It's a war of attrition.
And it's one of those like, silly, like, people have done it because they can. So you can beat the game with anything technically. And I'm sure there's a perfect meta. But it's really just what you prefer. It's just knowing that the biggest choice you make is literally right away and which characters are which. And again, you might refer to the manual for that because they actually give you more information. But until you start playing it once or twice through, you start realizing, and you don't even have to play it once or twice through. Honestly, if you play for like an hour or two and don't like your team comp, just restart the game real quick. It doesn't take that long to get that far.
And I will say, I did not beat this game. I did not have the time to. It's like a 30-hour RPG or so.
I don't even remember. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, really, the thing is just figuring out the map, which again isn't that difficult because in the original, where they give you the manual, and the manual has the entire world map available to you. So there is no world map in game. It's actually in the manual. So you can look up a Google thing of what the map looks like. But it's the hardest thing is just exploring, doing the random fights, keep moving forward. And then it's a lot of money farming. This is like the one where experience is super great and awesome, but you've got to farm the money to get the swords and the gear. And you also have to buy your magic. So keeping that in mind, if you went for fighters, right? The gear in the beginning of the game is super expensive. In order to gear up four fighters, it would take you forever because you have to harvest so much money. Yep. So it's a balance. You don't want all spellcasters because it's going to take too much money. Black belt's a good option because you don't have to start buying weapons for him anymore. So it's cheaper in your
But court. Then you're also weak to begin.
So So it's like a little bit of a balance. You pick your favorite guys, you roll through, and then whatever consequences you have, that's your consequence. But really, it's just a trade-off. Damage, magic, just go. Just have a little bit of everything.
We were talking about this off mic. We were saying how like this is one of those RPGs where it's a classic RPG in the sense where it's just pure grinding pretty much.
Oh yeah.
There is a decent enough story involved with it. It's simple, but it's like got a cool little plot twist at the end, which we'll get to. Spoiler alert for the story later on.
The plot starts off real easy. It tells you right off the bat there's these four heroes. Come to this land to kind of save it. And it starts off in like this little tutorial island. You can't even leave the island until you fight the first boss, and then it opens up a bridge to the rest of the world. Then you can really go from there.
And that bridge is actually a really seminal moment in video game history because it was one of the first times it made the game feel cinematic. Because so you start out in the castle of Corneria, actually.
Yep.
I actually wrote this down. So The four heroes are first tasked. They have to rescue the Princess Sarah from the Temple of Fiends.
Right away.
She was kidnapped by the evil knight Garland, and once rescued, she is returned to her father, the King of Corneria, which I was always wondering, did they get the name of that from, like, Star Fox get their name from that? I don't know. Once he is rescued, the king builds a bridge to give the warriors passage to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very simple thing. But at the time, especially on the NES, there hadn't been a lot of games like that would go past that. In almost every, this is a little bit of a regurgitated point, not from me, but from another podcast I listened to called Retronauts. They were talking about how they, up to that point, once you rescued the princess, the game was over.
That's it.
But not in this game. That's just the beginning. They kind of subvert the player's expectations, mm-hmm, by having what the trope was at the time be completed in the first like 10, 15 minutes of the game, or right, like an hour or whatever.
It's like a side quest.
Yeah, pretty much. And then once you cross that, once the king builds that bridge, you return the princess, the king builds the bridge, and once the king builds it, you walk across it, and then you get a flash screen, and it just says Final Fantasy, and that's where you hear the Final Fantasy theme for the first time.
The greatest music in the world, yeah.
I'm hearing it right now in my head.
I know. It's stuck. That's what is consistent through all the Final Fantasy games, is that intro.
A lot of music from this game still repeats, even the battle theme. I know, oh, not theme, that battle changes. Theme, but the victory music.
The victory music and the Final Fantasy, that intro sound is what's
the intro
through.
Music, the victory music, a lot of the tropes from the, you can see a lot of the foundations of the rest of the series in this game.
Not sure.
From the get-go. And I was saying before, we actually just recorded another episode for the upcoming project I mentioned in the year-end episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about D&D in it without giving anything away about what the game was just yet. But
this is heavily influenced by it. But, I mean, yeah, you got swords and magic, but like, the magic system is all that's old what I'm thinking style. Of. Yep. Where you get spell slots. And even in this, you have level 1 through, I forget how high it goes, 7 or 8, spell slots, or, stages of magic level 1, 2, all the way up to 8, but you only can buy 3 from your level 1 slot, 3 for your level 2 slot, and the game gives you more magic than you can. So, like, there are
actually... So you have to pick and choose.
Yeah, pick and choose your characters, yep, which is why it's another thing of building your character. If you got a red mage and a black mage, you have access to all of the magic. Where if you only have one offensive spellcaster, then you can't have all of it.
And
if you did
red, black, and white, you literally have all everything. Healing and all offensive magic right. at your fingertips right there.
Yeah, but then you have to say, all right, you get some of this, then you get the other half of it. So you got to pick and choose, and which isn't that terrible. The magic really isn't that impressive, I guess. Like, there's the straight up damage dealers.
You could see, since it was on the NES, the animation wasn't all that.
Oh, the animation was like flashing lights, but like the effects of the magic were, you could do without. That's what I'm saying. Probably. Like, there were enhancements. There were a lot of things that would up your dodge rate a lot more, and things that would just up your damage, and obviously the straight damage that the offensive spellcasters could do. The White Mage's abilities were pretty insignificant. The only thing they had going for them was a fire, a ice, which is just anti.
White Mages could do that?
They could do anti-fire.
Oh,
anti-ice.
No, so it's
it's called A-Fire. A-F-I-R.
I thought you were saying like A-Fire like as an a singular fire. No, it's literally called A-Fire.
A-Fire, because it's anti. Because when you run into your fiends, you run into a fire fiend, anti-fire your team, so they take half fire damage.
And I guess we can kind of use that as a segue then to talk about some more of the systems that were regarding magic, is the fact that since this was the NES, they could not have a lot of, they couldn't spell out everything they wanted. So it wasn't called like, you wouldn't see Fire 3, you would see like FRE3 or something like that.
Yeah, FIR3, like it's something like that, like they abbreviated it. And again, one of those games where you kind of need to have the manual, because the manual would tell you exactly what that spell did. If you just went into the game, all right, you know what mute does. Useless ability. But then as a white mage, one of your first skills is harm. Sounds great. Hits everybody. Except it doesn't. It only hurts undead creatures. You don't get that information from the game. So it's a bunch of... When you play this game now, and especially you're probably not going to have the manual, it's kind of like, have Google up. Google that spell. What does that spell do? Google what the map of Final Fantasy World 1
looks
like. And
it's not even like you're cheating, because it's literally, like, they gave the players that from the get-go in the beginning.
Absolutely. And you just need to have it. Like, if you know a fire is anti-fire, obviously buy that one.
I think that's, like, that's got to be a trend that they had in Final Fantasies in general, because even in Final Fantasy VII, if you think about, if you play Final Fantasy VII, you look at the instruction booklet, they have a little walkthrough for the first section of the game for you in the back half of that manual, which is kind of weird that they would, I shouldn't say weird, but it's kind of, I remember when I first was playing Final VII, I thought that was really cool that they gave you that little bit of an intro almost to the game through that. So they've kind of done, I guess, stuff like that for a while now. Hell, even since we already did Final Six, spoiler alert for Final Six /3, they kind of allude to the big plot twist right there, because you have the world map. You have the regular world in the world of darkness, or what is it?
Destruction,
whatever the name of it. It's the light and dark world, pretty much. And you don't know exactly why there's a world of dark just yet until you get to that part in the game, which I won't say why. If for those who have not played it, it's a pretty good plot twist.
It is. And even with the map in Final Fantasy I, it wasn't just like a little like page in your manual. It was a big fold out map that you could hang. Like it was pretty impressive.
I wanted, so I was showing you off, we were off mic. I was showing Jamie the Sega Pico that I got. I had a chance to either get that or a complete inbox copy of the original Final Fantasy. I was like, well, I already own the original.
The choice disappointed me, everyone.
What are you talking about? The Sega Pico is great.
It is a cool thing, but I would love to have a sealed Final Fantasy.
It was not sealed, but it was complete in box.
Well, yeah, a complete thing. It's amazing.
Sealed. I don't understand sealed collectors, because
not sealed clip, but yeah, having the whole kit and caboodle of it would be awesome.
I was going to say, I just don't understand sealed collectors, because why would you buy something that you literally can't open?
For fun.
Okay, touche. You called my bluff.
I mean, to be honest with you, I still have a Legend of Zelda Wind Waker for the Nintendo Cube that's still sealed with plastic wrap. And that's only because my brother and I, now I'm going to upset some people, didn't like that game at all. So
we didn't try it.
Yep, you're right. We left it sealed. We didn't like the art. And we're like, nope.
So you didn't, it's not that you didn't like it. You just didn't try it.
Nope, we didn't try new things.
This is actually, I guess, a real controversial opinion that you'll get some hate for. Jamie here doesn't like Ocarina of Time. And so because him being scorned by that game, he didn't try Wind Waker.
No, it's not that I don't like it. I just think that Link to the Past was the superior version of the game.
And no, it's funny. Retrospectively, I agree with you now.
That's right. I mean, it was really good. Don't get me wrong. It was a great game, and it was fantastic 3D, but I just liked... I mean, I grew up on Link to the Past, and that was my game.
Link to the Past, admittedly, is a little... Not a little. I think it's a better structured game. But anyway, so after you rescue... Go back to Final Fantasy.
Right.
After you rescue the princess and you get that cool little splash screen.
Princess Sarah. Very creative.
One of my favorite things about old NES games are the shitty localizations. I was showing you the game Kabuki Quantum Fighter beforehand. And what was the dude's name? It was like John...
Generic action.
I think
guy
it was
name.
Thomas O'Connor or something like that. And it was developed by a Japanese studio, so they wouldn't name their character Thomas O'Connor.
No, it's very silly. But yeah, you keep the bad guy's name Garland. Like, that's a super casual name everybody has.
It's just strange because localization has come a long way since what it used to be.
Yeah. Well, speaking of names, you can even, I mean, for people who have never touched FF1, you name your guys too, so you can name them whatever ridiculousness
you want. But you only have four letter slots.
That's right, because apparently we can't do more than that.
Oh, it's so obnoxious. So I named Kara... because I'm a fan of the anime Karas, but I couldn't fit Karas. So I'm like, I don't feel like changing it. Then I was like, I don't know what to call the black belt. So I called him Man, but I spelled it with two A's. So it was Man. then you have the white mage was He's, like H-E-E-Z, because she's gangster or something. I don't know. I forget what I named the black mage.
Yeah, you can make everything just.
Oh, but I named the black mage Vivi because that's Final Fantasy IX. That's a great name.
Consistent.
I love Final Fantasy IX, man. But yeah, so after he builds a bridge and you see that awesome splash screen, you go across to the eastern part of the continent and you can explore around a little bit. But if you explore around enough, there's two places you can go. There's a cave with a witch in it, And then there is also the city of, I actually wrote it down, Pravoka. And you have to rescue the town of Pravoka from pirates.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember playing it or getting to that point, and you would actually, one of the first things that you see as you walk in, you talk to a villager there, and the first thing they say, so if you don't know what you're doing, you're just going around talking to villagers so you can understand. The first villager that you see, literally, the first villager, mm-hmm. first NPC in the town says, help, and that's all it says. And the next one above it says, we're under attack by pirates or something, or the town's been taken over by pirates. But watching you play Jamie a little bit, I was a little disappointed because that's about where I got. That's about where I stopped in my playing.
How large the invasion force was?
It's what, 12 guys?
Nine guys. That's as much as they can have in one combat sequence.
And then, but I'm amazed they didn't have more than one combat sequence. It was just the one. And then as soon as you defeat the one combat sequence,
the captain gives up and gives you the ship.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously.
It's so anticlimactic, I would say. I mean, granted, it's not the end of the game, so you still have a lot to go.
Oh, sure.
But it's still super anticlimactic that that's how you defeat the pirates.
Yeah, just beat them up.
Now, I want to talk about this. The battle, and just thinking of having to fight all those guys makes me think of this.
Mm-hmm.
The battle mechanics for this game are so primitive, and I don't mean that. I understand, like, it was there was a long
learning curve. You're talking about the targeting system?
The targeting system, yeah. Specifically. So in this game, when you target an enemy, if you, in every other Final Fantasy, you normally, at least more newer Final Fantasies, I should say, you would have all of your guys, all of your characters attack one target, and if that target was defeated, your enemies would just attack, your characters would just attack another random enemy, or maybe next just the next lineup. One down in the lineup, yeah. Right? In the original Final Fantasy, you can't do that. If you send them all to attack the same enemy and that enemy gets defeated, every other character who had attacked it, who chose to attack it since it's been defeated, will just waste their turn.
Yep, it says attack ineffective because they make the attack animation, they attack the creature or target that was in that slot, and then just nothing because he's already dead. Because
it's air. You're literally just swinging at air, so it's body. Ineffective.
Yep.
So you actually have to plan out your attacks a little bit more in this, where you would have to swing. So you would have to plan out.
You got to divvy up your damage.
Yeah, you have to divvy it up.
And you really got to pay attention because, you know, obviously different characters deal different amounts of damage, but you don't know how much health your opponents have. So you got to really pay attention to, okay, first fight, maybe all your guys wail on the first dude you find. All right, he goes down in one hit. Then you got to divvy up four different of your guys' attacks to four different enemies. And then you just kind of keep playing around. You really got to pay attention to count how much damage you've dealt, how much health they have, how much damage you guys, your team's going to deal. So you really got to, like, involve yourself in the combat and pay attention to it.
And a lot of it's very much guess, test, revise in the sense because, like you were saying, if you don't know the health points of the enemy you're fighting, then you run a really high risk, a high chance of
just getting
the ineffective thing over and over and over again. And it's really fucking obnoxious having to deal with that.
Well, one of the first things I was showing you, the hardest first enemy you fight is when you finally have the boat and you're on the water. And it is the shark. It's just a shark. That's the hardest thing you fight because the shark has somewhere between like 100 and 130 hits, something like that. I was just testing around with it. And you don't know that. Your fighter hits for about maybe 25, 30 a swing. Your spellcaster, if you bought ice in the second town, might hit for like 30 to 40 damage, right? But you don't know that, so you just got to really just keep wailing on it until it dies. So, and then, of course, you find two sharks in a fight. You kind of back out of that fight or just really focus fire. Like, you have to really figure out how you got to divvy up your dude's damage to make sure that they don't keep just beating up on you.
And also make sure that you're taking out the enemies that are going to do the most amount of damage to you first.
Oh, sure.
That way. That goes for pretty much every RPG, every Final Fantasy. You should always take out the enemies that are going to hurt you the worst. That's just basic strategy.
But in this one, it's harder because Final Fantasy 1 is all about a game of attrition. Like, once you start getting into the fiend's lairs, you can't just heal. You have to buy things to heal, of course. It seems pretty arbitrary, pretty obvious,
especially,
but it's expensive.
But, well, it's not as obvious as you would think for a more experienced RPG. Well, I shouldn't say experienced, for someone who's used to more modern RPGs, because more modern RPGs, you're used to being able to heal for a good number of times or healed the entire party. This one, since it's D&D, like we were talking about before, you only have a certain number of spells you can use.
Your spell slots
You only get three cures in the beginning of the game. Do you get more of single
spells?
You do.
So like you unlock like tier 2 and 3 and 4 again all the way up to max.
Well,
and
I knew that, but as you unlock tier 2, does your tier 1, do you get more uses out of tier 1 spells?
Yep, exactly. It's just like the old D&D where you get more level 1 spells to cast, not that you know, but to cast as you're unlocking your tier 2's magic to do.
And to be clear, when we say you can only cast three cures, that means that cure is a level 1 spell, meaning if you only can use three total level 1 spells, that means anything. So if you use all of them on three cures, any other level 1 spells, like harm, like you mentioned before, that would do a lot of damage to the undead,
it's
useless. Can't do it. You've already used it up for the three cures.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get the obscene amount of cures. Like what I would, 9 times out of 10, when I played Final Fantasy X, I almost never had to use potions because my healers would just take care of everything. Because you would have so much.
Yeah, you have a cure all and everything. Yeah, you no such thing in this.
You would have, there would be so much MP that you could just cure like five, you know, like 15, 20, 30 times. And by that time, you'd be at another town and you'd be rested and you'd have all your MP back.
Sure.
So there really wasn't all that much challenge with that. With this, you have to be very, you need to buy a lot of.
You'd be very intentional with it. You can't cure all either. It's just single target cures. So you got to be very careful for a very long time about, okay, oh, this guy just got hit for 30 points damage out of 70. Yeah, I'm going to use a cure here on him. Like your cures are like last resort in the middle of combat.
And they're fucking expensive as shit.
Yeah, I mean, if
the spells
potions,
are not. Yeah, the potions are expensive. I mean,
so when you get them, you hold on to them and you use them outside of combat. Actually, well, you can use them inside. Really, it's you use your cure magic in combat, potions outside because you spam little ones, but it's expensive. It's like 60 gold a potion. In the beginning of the game, 500 gold is like a fortune for you. So,
and the worst part is that, well, in the beginning of the game, we talked about this off mic as well, that it's almost smarter to not buy potions and just save up money on other stuff because
it
costs only 30 gold to completely heal all of your characters if you go to the town and sleep in the inn.
Sure.
So you could just hover around town and just level up. Hell, even in the second town, it's 50 gold. So that's still 10 gold cheaper than a potion that's going to only partially heal one character.
Oh, yeah, that stays like that the entire game. The only time you should be using potions and heals is when you're in a dungeon, really. Or, you know, you're just out in the world and it doesn't really matter. But, yeah, you just, the game requires you, without actually letting you know, that you just need to leave town, walk a couple paces around town for a while, and just harvest cash, experience. You don't actually go exploring too frequently until you feel comfortable in the new area. But you just hang outside, do a couple fights, go back, heal, come outside, you know, kill a couple more mobs, go back in, heal until you feel that you can beat them pretty thoroughly. Then you can explore further.
And where I got to, both in my play and also in like Let's Plays that I was watching to kind of get a little bit more familiar with the game, is after you defeat the pirates in that second town, the game opens up a lot because now you have a ship to sail around with.
Feels like it opens up a lot. There is a lot. It does. You're in a lake, and there's only one other port, the dock at.
Oh, really?
The water is very difficult.
It's huge.
Yeah, it looks very huge, and you get very lost. And that's the thing with the original games, that you do want to explore places to look for stuff. You're not going to find it, but you just need to do a lot of repetitious battles. But it's really just going to the opposite side. Like if you start in the northeast, you go down to the southwest and there's the port for the next town. And the town is right there because then the monsters.
All the ports are right next to the towns.
Yeah, because the water has a bunch of tough guys. And then when you get to the next area, you're dealing with giants who hit like trucks, have the amount of health that a truck would have. And then they also have weak poison.
How many
snakes.
Hit points would a truck have?
I don't know, like 200? It's got a lot. It's got a lot for the game. It's a ton. But you sit there and you harvest that third town for like a good hour because you get access to level 2, 3, and 4 spells in that town and like some of the top tier for the time weapons and armor for your fighter. And, you know, if we say 500 gold is a lot of money in the beginning of the game, the third town isn't that far in. And the weapon for the fighter is the silver sword at 4 grand. And that takes time to get.
Holy shit.
And in that time, you're not just sitting there harvesting the cash, but you're exploring. You're trying to figure out where the next little mini dungeon is. There's a castle you have to go to. And that's honestly like the first checkpoint of the game. That is the hardest part because you don't have your gear, you don't have items, you barely have spells, and it asks you to go into this little black hole, which is already far away from the town, dive 3 or 4 levels into it, and that entire time that you're trying to make that trek, it's just full of poison enemies. So not only are you loading up potions, you're loading
up on antidotes
left and right, because that stuff kills you more than monsters do. And then at that point, it's just a roll the dice. You got to get in, go down 4 levels, get back, and then get back to town safely. So it takes a lot of like just dipping your toe in, and then just leveling up and gearing up.
And it just leads back to what we were saying before. This game is a grind fest. It is there. You have to grind so much just to be able to progress at a at a comfortable pace.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess
it gets easier. It definitely the fiend's layers. Like right now, you're just trying to start your quest, because the idea is you kill Garland, he unleashed these fiends, you're trying to find them. Everything you're doing up to this point is so you can literally start that quest. You're just trying to open up the waterways to get into the world to start doing the fiends area. And the fiends areas are actually pretty predictable. I think it's the third fiend, maybe it's the second fiend. It's the fiend of fire, whatever it is. It's a volcano you have to go in. Pretty cool. But it's one of those things where it's repetition. You go in, and you either go left or right. You go down the hall, left or right. Go down the hall, left or right. If you just go left every single time, you're right there at the fiend. But you don't know that until you dip your toe in. And then just go in a little further and back out, a little further and back out each time. And there's optional treasure. But like the fiend's layers are pretty predictable, but also very, very risky. Because you can't, again, it's a war of attrition with Final Fantasy.
It's just tedious and monotonous. And it's
But you know, it's a mental game. That's what it is. It's managing your materials, making sure you're geared, figuring it out. It's you remembering the labyrinth, you remembering the lair, remembering the enemy's health.
It kind of reminds me of that feeling when you are, like, the game is consistently that feeling of when you are 4 levels deep into a dungeon, or you know, you're in the second to last level of a dungeon, you don't want to go back up because you know you're going to die trying to get back out of the dungeon.
Oh yeah.
And there's no escape plan, and you also are afraid to progress further because you don't know if you can necessarily survive progressing
absolutely
further. So it gives you that level of intensity, but all the time, because you don't know if this fight's going to kill you half the time. I mean, a lot of the early stuff isn't so bad, but when you stray away far from town,
it's dangerous.
You don't know if you're going to make it back to town or not.
And the game only saves at an inn, so mm-hmm. there's no saving on the spot. It's you have to be out of town, use an inn, or you just lost the last hour of play if you mm-hmm. tried. So it's very much, yeah, you can go for it. But then you got to redo all that again. Now, nicely with the fiends, it took me the second fiend. I was foolish enough to not realize if you beat the fiend and then walk 2 steps forward, there's an orb you can use that warps you outside of it. The first fiend I did, I was like, oh, okay, now I got to get out of here, because that's what the game has taught me so far. But yeah, so the second, third, and fourth fiend were a lot easier when I realized there's an orb that just warps you right out.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But just use that.
Good to know. Yeah. So we can talk. We can keep on talking about, I guess, the story. But
the story is super easy.
But after we get out of the pirate town and mm-hmm. you sail across, you go to another village there, and
the Elf Kingdom.
So yeah. where does the first fiend actually come into play? Is it near the Elf Kingdom?
So you go to there's a lot of like side questing around at this point. So you go to the Elf Kingdom. And it's not even like a kingdom at this point. It is like a, it's more of like a, it is a town, but it's more city size because there's a lot of stuff you can buy there. You realize that the Elf Kingdom has already like kind of like fallen apart, which is why there's this like deep black hole you have to go into, get some stuff out of that. I think you find the mystic key in that, which you find a lot of chests that are mystically locked. And you're like, So you have to then...
And that's the ones where you can go all the way back to the first kingdom and unlock stuff.
And then you start running around for fun. Because while you're looking for the Elf Kingdom and that black hole well after that elf town, you also find a little hole in the wall for the dwarves. So you've got dwarves, you got elves, you got this witch, you got the first kingdom. So you have to dive into this dark hole, find the mystic key, run all the way back to First Kingdom, open up those chests, take some dynamite, or it might be the orb. I forget the order of it. But it's just like a lot of like, oh, I have this now. Oh, I have to go back to
them.
It
turns into one of those chain quests.
It's a delivery quest.
Delivery quest.
Yeah. And then eventually, it is the orb that you take to the witch, and the witch gives you this dynamite to take to the dwarves, and the dwarves blow open a piece of land. So the first lake you're sailing in then turns into like the ocean, where like you can now explore the rest of the world. And you sail for about 2 seconds west, And then you run into like this blighted land, and you run into the first fiend, which is the earthen fiend. And he's like, corrupt the land. You've run into a town that's just like battered and broken, and the like everything's destroyed and the people are dying. So you pretty much have to go and kill the earth fiend. So you stop the spread of corruption. And then from there, you're just going from town to town. You go to the volcano one.
Which is probably the fire fiend, I would assume.
Yep, you get the fire fiend. There's a water fiend.
And an air, probably. I think it's like the four like
elements. That's actually the one I can't remember is the one that probably didn't give me that much trouble because I cannot remember it. I can't remember. The water one, I think, was the last fiend. And then it's the earth and the fire, the first two. Whatever the third one, wasn't that hard. It really wasn't that hard because I would probably remember it being that difficult. But the fiends themselves aren't bad. They are just a major just damage race. You throw up your anti-fire, anti-water, whatever it is, and then you just race to hurt, kill them before they finish off whatever, you know, little rinky-dink health you got left.
Yeah, okay. So I'm looking it up now. So the earth fiend, his name is Lich.
Yeah,
fire fiend is Kary, K-A-R-Y.
Right.
The Levestone.
Really they right. name them and stuff, yeah. But it's just fire, just different elements. They even call it out.
Okay, so once you... That's weird. After you get the Earth Fiend and Fire Fiend, the King of Dragons, Bahamut, promotes each Light Warrior.
Yep.
A kind gesture is repaid by a fairy receiving special liquid that produces oxygen, and the warriors use it to defeat the water fiend Kraken. Okay.
There you go.
And then the...
He's pretty easy, too.
The floating castle that Tiamat, the Wind Fiend, estate. So then you fight Tiamat, the Wind Fiend, and with the four fiends defeated, the orbs restored, a portal opens in the Temple of Fiends, which is where you first started out, is where you fight Garland.
Yep.
And it takes you
2,000 years
into the past, where the warriors discover that the four fiends sent Garland, now the archdemon Chaos, back in time, and he sent the fiends to the future to do so, creating a time loop which he could live forever. So they would send him back, he would just live the whole thing, and he would send them forward, and it would just create a time loop. So you find out that the four heroes of light. The legend of the four heroes of light that you hear about in the beginning, like where this prophecy comes from, is because you defeated him 2,000 years in the past. Yep. And it's just the...
You beat him in the past, you beat him in the future, and then you just end the cycle. Yeah, end the loop. Yeah, and it's kind of cool. You go into the past, but all you can do is stay in the Temple of Fiends. You can't go into the overworld back in the time.
And I mean, it was also Which such an... Fine. It was it's the first game in the series. Yeah. They were still growing, like learning.
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, this is one of those like, it's one of those things. It's a fairly common bit of video game trivia. But the reason this game was even called Final Fantasy was because the company was going to go under. Square was pretty much dying. The only other games they had really made up to that point that Americans would, I mean, there's probably a couple that I can't think of, but the big one off the top of my head, they made Rad Racer. For the NES, which is a fairly popular title. And it was also popularized in The Wizard, you know, the 1989 movie. Because when Lucas, the kid with the power glove, is playing Rad Racer with it. And then he's, you know, he's like, I love the power glove. It's so bad. and so, yeah, they made Rad Racer, but they really hadn't seen a whole lot of success as of recent at the time. And it was pretty much the last ditch effort. It was going to be their Final Fantasy. And the only reason they even made it is it was originally going to be a Dragon Quest clone, because Dragon Quest was super popular. It was outrageously popular. Yeah. It's known as Dragon Warrior in the States. Then after it was Dragon Warrior, like 1, 2, 3. And then finally after, I don't know which one it was, they finally started calling it the same in both Japan and the US. And Dragon Quest is a better name than Dragon Warrior, in my opinion. Dragon Warrior just sounds a little too like.
Well, that's when Dragon Warrior was when there was still just one guy in the party. It was just you versus the world, and then it turned into like parties, and then you get groups and teams. Yeah,
it's always interesting because the Dragon Quest games in general, a lot of the art's based off of Akira Toriyama's art. He does a lot of stuff like that. You know, Dragon Ball Z. He's the guy who did Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, and then he also did the art for Chrono Trigger. Which God, I love Chrono Trigger.
That was a good one.
But yeah, so Final Fantasy was the product of them making a last ditch effort to save the company.
And it worked.
One of the most popular series of all time, and is still to this day outrageously popular in just about everywhere.
A lot of games. not as great anymore, but yeah.
15's pretty good. It's not as as good as the older ones, but compared, like, it's better than 13, so that's a step forward. 13 I could not get into.
Once they started hitting the double digits, I started tapping out, to be honest with you.
10 was really good.
It took me until last year, 2019, maybe even the end of 2018, to actually finally play it and beat it.
10?
Yeah.
What did you think of it after you finally beat
it? It was good.
I know the thing is, it's never going to live up to the nostalgia you have of, like, the old games, right. But at the same time, it's still a pretty good game.
I just remember it being easy.
There was a couple, it was easy there for was the a, most part.
Yeah, there was a little bit fights. Of hard spots.
There's a, when you fight Seymour,
yeah.
Through, I was awful because he, I didn't.
Well, of course you were awful. The game was so easy, then it asked you to do something.
Yeah, well, then it actually asks you to use strategy. Like, yeah. you have to constantly cast a thing that nullifies, like, elemental spells. So yeah. You spend the first half of the fight just casting elemental nullifications on your entire party, so that way Seymour doesn't fucking wreck the shit out of you,
which is exactly what you'll be doing in Final Fantasy 1 the second you hit a feat and you anti whatever its element is, or else it will wreck you. 50
will it?
I think it's 50% damage reduction.
Oh my god.
It'll hit your whole party too, so you've got to cast it. But yeah, you need, like, an anti something, so save one of your spell slots at whatever magic level it is for that. Yeah.
Another fun thing that, like, not 100% related to this, but something I thought that was pretty interesting was Nintendo Power is running a contest where the winner could go. It was a Final Fantasy thing where the grand prize winner was getting taken to, like, this island to have, like, their ultimate Final Fantasy experience.
Yeah.
I don't know what that experience was or who won it or if it ever actually won, if anyone anything, ever won yeah, anything, yeah, yeah. You know, like, but they had a contest for you could, they would fly you out or boat you out to this, sail you out, I guess, to this island somewhere. And it was supposed to be this ultimate Final Fantasy experience, whatever the ultimate experience would be. I don't know.
It's very 8-bit, I'm sure.
So some of the cool things that I did a little bit of research on this, besides just, you know, listing the designers and Nobuo Uematsu, the fantastic composer for it.
I've seen his Distance World a couple times. They're so good.
Have you?
Yeah.
I've been meaning to go see one of those.
They're always fantastic to go to.
So the graphic designer, Kazuko Shibuya, Kazuko Shibuya, she worked on illustrations in the instruction booklet for the game Alpha. It was her first thing, so she did a lot of the design for it.
Okay.
She designed the famous intro screen for the original Final Fantasy. The iconic splash screen that we were talking about before. She designed all that.
That's cool.
With the silhouette of the four warriors on it. She did all the characters pixel art based on Koichi Ishii's designs. Koichi Ishii is the guy. You can kind of see it. You see my Japanese Final Fantasy VI up there?
Yeah, yeah.
He did that artwork. So she would do a lot of the pixel artwork based off of his designs.
Nice.
Was that Koichi Ishii? But then Koichi Ishii would later go on to work on the Mana series.
Right.
Like Secret of Mana kind of stuff. Yoshitaki Amano. That's the guy who did the artwork. Koichi Ishii is the... So Yoshitaki Amano did a lot of the concept art for it.
Mm-hmm.
Koichi Ishii was the lead artist for it. So he would create other designs for characters and she would do the pixel art for him.
Fair enough.
Yoshitaki Amano did the artwork that I was talking about.
There you go.
And most of the characters...
good for her giving us the Black Mage.
Right. So, yeah, Yoshitaki Amano was used to create the concept art, but most of the character designs were first created by Shibuya and Koichi Ishii. So the two artists were the main designers for the majority of this game. Just Yoshitaki Amano, he helped kind of help the series find its tone, I guess, for lack of a better term, because his art would really show what type of enemies they would want to include into it and what type of world they wanted to build.
Sure.
And then you can see it, like, with that, like, that Final Fantasy VI box art is really cool looking.
Oh, yeah,
I think
it's Final Fantasy VI art is amazing.
And you can see, though, like, the vibe of Final Fantasy VI is screaming right off of that. Like, that feels very...
Oh, yeah.
It feels like the same tone as the
Metal and Magic
and
Age.
My Final Fantasy IV one, which is Final Fantasy II in the U.S., That box art isn't quite as indicative, but you still kind of get the idea from it. Because Final Fantasy II was a lot more child-friendly, I guess you could say. Like, Final Fantasy VI was a lot more darker story.
Final Fantasy II was very easy. Like, I remember playing Final Fantasy I when I was a kid, and I didn't understand it. My brother and I played it, and we got to the third town, which is, like, maybe if you play it pretty quickly, like an hour or two into the game. But we got to that one and reset, because we always wanted to make a new group, a new party. But we didn't actually ever get anywhere close to being Final Fantasy. It was way too hard for us then. But Final Fantasy II was super easy. That was on rails, and that was, you couldn't mess it up. There was no choices that you could screw up.
It was a lot. It made it a lot easier as a branch in for kids. And I do think that it's kind of interesting to go back to see. I guess we can use this to lead into kind of closing out our conversation on the original Final Fantasy. But it's interesting to see where the roots of the series, as well as going back and just kind of appreciating what they did with the limited space and technology they had at the time.
Yeah.
They did a lot of cool stuff with it, considering the limitations of the NES. And also, you could see what they wanted to do, but they couldn't quite get around to doing it.
The story was interesting in number one, but like, I don't know. It wasn't constantly reminded of what was actually happening until the very end of the game. And you're like, oh, that's what was happening.
I find myself playing a lot of games like that lately. For this podcast, whenever I try out like an old game again or for a first time, the storyline's so...
they don't ever remind you. They just kind of like hit you at the end. By the way, this is what you've been doing. The old games are so on rails because... Even with Final Fantasy, you go this way and then you go that way. Because if you go this way, you're just going backwards. So you just
Only one way you can really go.
Yep. Until something happens.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you just grind through it and whatnot. So I guess to wrap this all up, do you think that this game still holds up today? Do you think objectively do the mechanics hold up? I understand the presentation is dated and there's flaws with its presentation, but overall, do you think its mechanics hold up? I'm not even talking about the visual presentation.
It's hard.
The technological limits of only four characters for everything, having to use four characters to describe Thunder.
Well, that's fine. I like that. Well, I mean, no, that doesn't, because that was outdated even when it was in place. Like the idea that you can't just spell it out or even have a little blurb of what it does or how many targets it hits. So that the fact that you have a limited amount of spells to buy for the spell slot, like the system is outdated. But then I say that, and I also can acknowledge that they did a Final Fantasy I remake where things are easier and they fixed those problems and everything is much more transparent. Even like buying weapons in the game was hard. You buy the weapon based on, again, the manual. Can your classes that you picked use the weapon? And then you look at it and say, okay, is this weapon better than that weapon? Because yes, this weapon's more expensive than that weapon. And that's the way that you would gauge if it was better or worse than another weapon. So there's a lot of mechanical tweaks that need to happen. Overall, it's still a playable game as long as you go into it understanding that it's a slower, grindier RPG. It doesn't have many events to keep you into it. You have to keep yourself going through the story, tracking all your stuff. So if you like the hard old style RPGs, it's fantastic still. It still holds up for that. If you want it to be a little easier of a current RPG, then play the Final Fantasy I remake, and that tracks your health a lot easier. That tracks everything a lot easier. The gameplay, from what I understand, is a little simpler to combat, like everything. It just tells you the power level of the weapons, the armor, the monsters. So if you want a little easier, play the remake. If you like a hardcore, the old style tough RPGs, play the original one. It's perfectly fine. Just know that you want to have Google up so you know what that spell does. That doesn't make any sense when you slash letters together.
And what your characters can use and what's good for them and everything.
Honestly, it's still just fun to mess around with rolling in with like two warriors, a black mage and a white mage. But it's just dabbling. It does require just a touch of research before you put your party together. And even if you like the guess and test process, it's still fine because fighting the first guy, crossing the bridge, getting the second town takes you like 45 minutes. So you're not really losing that much time.
I will say for me, what I like about it is that it is very clear. It's what I had a point in my head and now it just like floated off there real quick. But what I like about it is that it is so customizable for a game of its time, with how customizable it is so far ahead of its time. Like, yeah. So it's super far ahead. It's like, super advanced.
Like we said, there's a lot of meta builds for the optimal, but like you can play it however you want to play it.
And that's the thing. Like if you look at any RPG or even, hell, not even RPGs, just shooters now that have RPG elements, how often do you think, like, how often do you see online now, well, this is the optimal build for this character. This is the optimal build for that character. This is, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's the same way even in this game. Granted, at the time, they didn't have the internet to help you with that type of thing.
That's why you guest test revised, rebuilt your team. You could do four warriors, which is silly, but then, you know, restart the game quickly with, you know, an actual team that makes it for you. And, of course, you get six characters that you can only use four of them. So that also encourages replayability for those that you want to, like, mess around with. You know, my compositions, fighter, black belt, red mage, and white mage. So you still have the black mage and the thief you can mess around with and try out if you want to do that.
Or do combinations of all four, like you said.
Yeah,
like,
just for fun.
I like the idea that there's full challenges developed around the fact, like, can I beat this game with only white mages? Or can I beat this game with only black mages?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's very silly difficult stuff to do stuff like that, because then you severely limit half of your your abilities. So
just more grindier. It's still a level-based game.
So, yeah, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap this up. I think we've talked in depth about the systems. We've talked in depth about the story. So I guess go out and play this game. If you have not tried it, it's definitely worth a try. Even I started enjoying it despite its limited mechanics. I was playing it on my NES, and I still had a good time with it. So, yeah, I guess thank you all once again for listening. Jamie, do you have anything you want to plug at all?
No plugs at all. I'm good.
Fair enough.
If you want more Final Fantasy, let me know, though.
I will probably have you on for others. So, yeah, as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. You can also email me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can check me out on Patreon, patreon.com/StillLoadingPod. Even just $1 a month will help me grow the show. If you want to support the show non-monetarily, you can also just give it a rating and review on iTunes or any of your podcasting apps, and that should do it. So Jamie, thank you for joining me on this episode for the inaugural episode of 2020 to kick off the whole kick off the year.
Yeah, man.
And I guess I should say, Dylan, thank you for suggesting this episode, for sending in this listener suggestion. So I would give out your last name, but I don't know if you want me to. But Dylan, thank you very much. So that should be it. And I will see you all next time.
Later.